Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, broadcasting video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, we are going to learn about how curcumin can benefit people with severe depression from Murdoch University in Australia, and how lentils provide a breakthrough in disease prevention, University of Western Australia, and also how aspartame, the artificial sweetener, can actually prevent you from losing weight and blocking intestinal enzyme activity from Massachusetts General Hospital, and consuming high amounts of saturated fat, which is what the average American does, is linked to an increased risk in heart disease, from Harvard School of Public Health, and more on health and healing. Lots on the environment today, including something I think we need to spend more time doing, and that is understanding what is it to live a simple life. You've heard me say many times, never confuse the complexity of a problem with the simplicity of its solution. And I'm going to go into that further today. I'm going to share some specific insights from Emery's Westacott from Aon on why a simple life is not just beautiful, but it's necessary for all of us. And also, at that same time, I'll be explaining why we're taking, I believe, a unfortunate turn in the wrong direction when it comes to dealing with debt. I'll explain that, and how our fear of debt or the amount of debt in our lives is keeping us from that simple life. So I'll tell you how much debt we have. I think you'd be shocked by the numbers, because it shows we've been living with pure illusion, and we can't buy ourselves happiness. You think you can? Then sit across from me each day when I counsel people, including some of the world's wealthiest people, and it didn't buy, their billions didn't buy them happiness. Just more anxiety, more misery. So we're going to talk about that. And then I'm going to share something I started a few days ago. I'm going to share with you some insights from some of the greatest philosophers in the history of the world. Today, specifically, on the topic of how a simple life is measurably more fulfilling than one that is complicated. And in that light, I believe that we should take a look at our entire system of governance, and who governs, how they get there, the lies that they tell us. It reminds me of the fall of the Roman Empire. So in that sense, I'm going to share from the week Pascal Emmanuel Gorby, America Now Looks Like Rome Before the Fall of the Republic, and I'll give you some specific examples on that. And I've already given a new term to this whole idea of the kleptocracy, the autocratic rule, those who are elite in power, and my new one is Tumbrocracy, about Tump viewing this as just a very good arrangement for him. It's just another business deal. Also, I just saw a study out that showed that the average speaker, including Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and the other candidates in this last campaign, were speaking at a fifth grade level, fifth grade to eighth grade maximum. And they went back in history and they found that the person who had the greatest skills of grammar and use of language was Abraham Lincoln. George Bush was the lowest, by the way, but Trump is right beside him. So if a person chooses not to master a simple skill such as English, and the linguistics of how to communicate, then what possibly would he be mastering when it comes to understanding the nature of our misery, what we need to change? So I'm going to deal with that as well. So you see, we have a lot. Plus, I have two audio clips and a newsmaker guest. The newsmaker guest will be showing you the latest on what's wrong with vaccines, and that is Norma Erickson, president of SameVax, and we're going to talk about the HPV vaccine. Boy, if there's one vaccine that you should never put into someone's body. It's that. We'll give you the latest on that. Also, someone that I counseled years ago, 20 years ago, who was near death, and you'll hear his story today. He passed recently. His name's Fred Fisher. Wonderful human being. But there's something to learn from his story. And that's why I'm playing this. As it happens, I suggested a simpler life to him. Now, he was not living a simple life. He was living a complicated by his emotions and his restricted circumstances. He was over 730 pounds, so he couldn't go very far. And so he took the time, and he joined me, and for a period of time, he lived the simple life. The results, you'll hear from him. And I haven't spoken to him in a while, but I was happy to see that he added 20 quality years onto his life. But boy, could we all learn lessons from Fred's journey. Now, I will be posting a little later today this video clip that I made at the time, because I just went through his day when he began his recovery, showing what's it like for someone who has been scorned and ridiculed because they're so big and mocked to get through a day. So that clip, which I found in an old archive, it's only 7 minutes long. I'm going to put that up later today so you can watch it, so you can see it. So you'll be hearing his voice, but you won't be seeing him when he's in the kitchen and his sister's making him juices, and he's in the gym and he's lifting weights. And then one scene, you see his pants. You won't believe how big his pants were. His belt was bigger than I am. I'm 6'2", and that belt was... I held the belt up. You'll see it in the video. So it's our way of commemorating a wonderful human being, a great journey. He took the hero's journey. And for all the people out there who feel angry, frustrated, depressed, lonely, that what's the point? Well, that's what he was, but he found a point. So we'll share that with you. Aspartame, as you know, is an artificial sweetener. I've written articles on it. I've studied it. And I would not recommend anyone consume aspartame. This is the latest from Massachusetts General Hospital. It was published in Applied Physiology, Nutrition, and Metabolism. Quote, a team of Massachusetts General Hospital investigators have found a possible mechanism explaining why use of the sugar substitute aspartame may not promote weight loss. In their report, published online in the scientific journal, the researchers show how the aspartame breakdown became phenylalanine, interferes with the action of an enzyme previously shown to prevent metabolic syndrome and a group of symptoms associated with type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. They also showed that mice receiving aspartame in their drinking water gained more weight and developed other symptoms of metabolic disorder than animals fed similar diets lacking aspartame. So, it was promoted, this sugar substitute, to promote weight loss and increase the incidence of metabolic syndrome. Now we're seeing it could do just the opposite. And this is not the first. Back in 2012, in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, a team found that feeding aspartame to mice kept on a high-fat diet was impacting them also. So stay away from aspartame. If you want something that is low calorie and won't spike your glycemic index, use stevia. And it comes in all different flavors now. You put one single drop of stevia into a hot tea, like an herbal green tea. Gives what you want, a vanilla, French vanilla flavor, it gives it to you. So that's what you use. From Murdoch University in Australia, curcumin supplementation shows benefit in people who have a need to reduce depression and other symptoms of major depression disorders. This was published in the Journal of Affective Disorders, and they found that there is a natural antidepressant activity in curcumin. Now, curcumin is the spice turmeric. It's from that. And saffron from people with severe depression also. Quote, so that's the study. So when you're taking curcumin, which I hope that you are, because, boy, does it turn off inflammation, helps prevent the spread of cancer in a person's body, you're also helping if you have depression. There's no side effects. There's over 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on curcumin. Every household should have curcumin. Everyone should have it available when they need it. And also, there was a study on consuming the average American diet, which is high in fat. Now, over the past 4 or 5 days, I've been at home, and then traveling, filming, and I decided I wanted to see what are they promoting on the different food channels. So I looked at all these different food programs, and one is really gruesome. It's just, it's absolutely barbaric, and that's that exotic food. Where he sees the animals and, oh, let's, you know, eat that. And you're looking in the eyes of a sentient creature that is gentle, that has a consciousness, and you're just looking at it as a new way of tasting some exotic part of its body. And but it's very popular, just like Man and Food was very popular. And but these are not people promoting anything healthy. In fact, I could find none of the health programs promoting health. In fact, my personal opinion, every single, no exception, every single program I watched, which is a bunch of them, from the cupcake shows to all these others, they promote disease. And yet, they're popular. So they're getting a lot of saturated fat into people's bodies. This is from Harvard School of Public Health, and this was published in the British Medical Journal. Consuming high amounts of 4 major fatty acids found in red meat, dairy, butter, and lard, and palm oil may increase risk of coronary heart disease. That's according to a study, quote, led by Harvard Chan School of Public Health. Their findings also suggest that replacing these fats with healthier fats, whole grains, plant proteins, may reduce coronary heart disease risk. Quote, our findings strongly corroborate what the current USDA dietary guidelines recommend. This includes reducing saturated fat intake to no more than 10% of the total calories and eating overall healthy diet that includes fruits, vegetables, whole grains, vegetable cooking oils, rich in polyunsaturated fats, monounsaturated fats, there's your olive oil, and nuts, legumes, fish. So, that's important. So if you want to slow down the aging process, if you want to prevent disease, it's a simple switching to a diet like this. I talked about this last evening. And by the way, I want to thank all the people from all over the world that tuned in for the world premiere over the internet of Plant Codes. It was extraordinarily well received because people in real time type in their comments, every kind of positive comment you can imagine. But it was the most beautiful documentary I've made, and, you know, the most lush and gorgeous scenery and the animation that took you inside the body, it took you in the gut, took you in the heart, took you in the brain, took you through your whole cardiovascular system to show you what happens when you eat bad food versus good food. And but we were, unfortunately, and I didn't anticipate this because we have a big bandwidth. It was filled up, so a lot of people couldn't get on. So we're going to correct that today. So people who could not get on can go on and take a look. But afterwards, we had a webinar, and I answered a lot of questions. And one of the issues came up, and it was about the role of animal proteins and fat in the diet. And I talked about the way to use fat. The healthy fats for cooking are 3, macadamia seed oil, coconut oil, and mustard seed oil. Those are very heat resistant, so therefore you can cook with those. But the oils I would not cook with at high heat at all, ever, were avocado, flaxseed, olive oil. I would not cook. I would put them in after the flame is turned off, and that imparts the flavor, but it does not interfere with their health qualities. But I mentioned this to them, and I'll share this as well. A person that I was asked to come on PBS National and debate with against a whole group of doctors who were not supportive of this was Dean Ornish. So there on this panel years ago, over 25 years ago, Dean Ornish, myself, and a whole group of people who didn't believe in veganism. But here's what Ornish did. In two separate studies, he proved absolutely unequivocally and scientifically that with nothing more than moderate exercise, with stress management, and with a purely plant-based diet, that you could reverse very advanced carotid artery blockage, all the different blockages of the arteries and heart disease. Now, I went down to his offices, and I spent a couple days, and I filmed his and interviewed all of his patients. So I was there during that study, and I spoke with the people, said a man who said, I was supposed to have had an operation, a stent put in, another person I was going to have balloon angioplasty, another person I was supposed to have coronary bypass. And today they were blood pressure healthy, cholesterol healthy, purely by lifestyle. So here's the question. If you published in the New England Journal of Medicine and you published in the Lancet, two of the most respected medical journals in the world, you've done it all by the numbers, all by the book, and then no one pays attention. I mean, no one. You publish a best-selling book. No one in medicine pays attention. There is no shift at all. Zero. And later, I would ask him, why do you think that is? And he didn't have an answer. He was perplexed. And I shared this with Dean Ornish over 20 years ago. I said, do you believe that it's not about proving? Because for you to prove that you have something that can prevent heart attacks and heart disease and other diseases, though you were looking not at cancer, diabetes, you were looking at heart disease, but it has the same impact on the other conditions, that the other people looking at your information have to decide which do they want, because we can only allow one dominant energy into our life to direct our belief systems and perceptions at any given time. So here you have all these doctors who have their specialties. They have their wrap down. They know what they're going to do with every patient comes in pretty much. They know which drugs to prescribe. Now you're telling them to change all that. You don't need the drugs. And everything you learned in medical school, which is about nothing when it came to health and nutrition, maybe an hour if you're lucky, that it was misinformation. You're asking him, in effect, to come back to medical school. You're asking him to change the way that they look at disease. You're asking them to look at how to make a body revitalized again. There's nothing in that medical paradigm, heavy in pharmacology, that's going to do that. So don't look at this as a doctor. Look at this as a mechanic. Because you're not seeing a real healer. You're seeing someone who is applying the principles of basic mechanistic, reductionistic technology to a human body. The brain, the beliefs, the body politics, the stress levels become irrelevant. They're merely looking at the symptoms and what do we have for that symptom. Not what caused it. Not what could reverse it. Not what could heal it. And he said, I don't want to think about that. Well, there are 900,000 plus doctors in the United States. You have under 100 practicing really holistic medicine using a vegan diet as the basis. So what is the percentage of, let's just round it off to 90 to 900,000. And it shows you that the people we consider the best and brightest, the most learned, are on the wrong side of truth when it comes to preventing disease or natural ways of treating it. And this was borne out in the film when every single doctor in the film was a board certified and was themselves healed by illnesses that orthodox medicine, their own profession, could not heal. And because they healed themselves, they then started healing their patients. Now they just use this for the patients. Psychiatrists, cardiologists, neurologists, all of them. So what does it take to change a paradigm? Or is it possible? In a truly free society, we would not try to change the existing paradigm. We would allow, even encourage, alternative points of view. But we don't. We should, but we don't. But I just wanted to share that with you because I have not found many people willing to come forward and say, yeah, I'm willing to change now. Are you sick? I'm not sick. I just don't want to get sick. We have maybe 5% of the American population who are actively living healthy, conscious lives. Now, that's about 18 million people. So we have a lot of people in this country who are making positive choices. The key is how can we influence the rest to do the same? I want to share a couple other things with you before we take a break. And one is people who have influenced throughout history our view of what we can do to live a more spiritual existence, one that is more ethical and moral to ourselves. And when we look today at how much stress we're under, part of the reason we're under stress is because we have chosen not to be concerned about our actions or their consequences, but only our ability to continue maintaining our positions of comfort. So if we want, you know, if we want whipped cream on top of a pie, we care about how we feel. I want my whipped cream. I want that soft drink. I want the French fries. I want the hamburger. I want the 3-pound hamburger. And I want it now. Friend, what about the consequences? I'll deal with that later. Now apply that to everything we do in life. If we have over 350,000 churches in the United States, and we have 350,000 homeless people, we have a lot more, then there shouldn't be any homeless people, should there? If they were living by the true spiritual principles. So once again, showing up without understanding the defining element that you're showing up to doesn't change anything. It's just accepting a ritual of meaninglessness because it makes us feel comfortable. When the government says it's going to do something, it never asks, is it being done right? Do we need this done? Is there a better way of doing it? They just do it. What's it cost? It's irrelevant. Someone else will pay the debt. On Black Friday, when 174 million Americans went out to buy something, the most of them didn't need it, then they create debt that they can't afford to pay, and that creates a crisis. How bad is it? U.S. unfunded liabilities, $104.3 trillion. The total U.S. debt, $66.8 trillion, just by some of the numbers. The U.S. national debt, $19.9 trillion. The total federal, state, and local spending debt, $6.7 trillion. Total personal debt, $17 trillion. Mortgage debt, $14 trillion. Student loan debt, $1.4 trillion. And credit card debt, $987 billion. That's not all of it, but that gives you an idea. Now, as a percentage of income, the gross domestic product, to total debt, which is not an accurate way of measuring it, we're over 1,000%. And yet we criticize Greece. We wanted them to go on an austerity program. We wanted to sell off their national treasuries and their ports and airports because we wanted someone to come in and buy that to pay against their debt. Who did they owe the debt to? To bankers and speculators. And yet we have more debt, according to all the statistics, of any other country in the world. We're bankrupt. We're totally, totally bankrupt. And yet we won't acknowledge it. We won't even have a conversation on it. And when do you see anyone talking about what we can do with this debt? Well, one thing we can do is we can start to live a simpler life where we don't put all of our attention into consuming. We have this obsession with consuming all the time, whether it's food or buying clothes we don't wear, cluttering our lives, something new all the time. And as a result, we forget what it would be like if we could wake up in the morning, not be burdened by debt, but have an abundance of joyful feelings. Low C. Be content with what you have. Rejoice in the way things are. When you realize there is nothing lacking, the whole world belongs to you. Confucius. Life is really simple, but we insist on making it complicated. Leonardo da Vinci. Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. Albert Einstein. If it can't be explained to a six-year-old, you don't understand it yourself. William James, an early psychologist, the art of being wise is the art of knowing what to overlook. Isaac Newton, truth is ever to be found in simplicity and not in the multiplicity and confusion of things. There's a Swedish proverb, fear less, hope more, eat less, chew more, wine less, breathe more, talk less, say more, love more, and all good things will be yours. For some of you of my generation, you'll remember and respect George Santayana, the Spanish philosopher and poet and novelist. The spirit's foe in man has not been simplicity, but sophistication. Each day, I would go down to, on my lunch break, I'd go down to a place and sit in a reading room down, because I had no money to buy anything, so a book. So I would sit there and read these little pamphlets, which I could read by Francis of Assisi. And one always has stuck with me. Pure, holy simplicity confounds all the wisdom of this world and the wisdom of the flesh. Henry Thoreau. As you simplify your life, the laws of the universe will get simpler. Solitude will not be solitude. Poverty will not be poverty, nor weakness, weakness. But he also said this, simplicity, simplicity, simplicity. I say, let your affairs be as 1, 2, 3, and to 100th or 1,000th. We are happy in proportion to the things we can do without. We can do without disease. We can do without war. We can do without conflict. Now, in that context, what am I talking about in the larger perspective? The good life is the simple life. Among philosophical ideas about how we should live, this one is hardly perennial. From Socrates to Thoreau, from the Buddha to Wendell Berry, thinkers have been peddling it for more than 2 millennia, and it still has plenty of adherents. Right now, there's the slow movement, which I support, slow eating, slow living, which advocates a return to pre-industrial basics. It attracts followers across continents. And through much of human history, frugal simplicity was not a choice, but a necessity. And since necessary, it was also deemed a moral virtue. But with the advent of industrial capitalism and a consumer society, a system arose that was committed to relentless growth, and with it, grew a population, meaning the market, that was enabled and encouraged by buying lots of stuff, and by traditional standards was surplus in everything. As a result, there's a disconnect between the traditional values we have inherited. I know my grandparents, my parents, lived through simplicity. They lived through the Great Depression. They lived through the Second World War and rationing. So I grew up appreciating simplicity, that all you need to be happy, you have here. You don't need their mansion. You don't need their car. You have it. So it was an inner journey. But where has that gone? Where has it gone? In pre-modern times, the discrepancy between what the philosophers advised and how people lived was not so great. Wealth provided security, but even for the rich, wealth was flimsy protection against misfortunes such as war, famine, disease, injustice, and the disfavor of tyrants. The Stoic philosopher Seneca, one of the richest men in Rome, still ended up being sentenced to death by Nero. As for the vast majority, slaves, serfs, peasants, and laborers, there was virtually no prospect of accumulating even modest wealth. And before the advent of machine-based agriculture, representative democracy and civil rights and antibiotics and aspirin, just making it through a long life without too much suffering counted as doing pretty well. Today, though, at least in prosperous societies, people want and expect and can usually have a good deal more, even if they can't afford it. Living simply now strikes many people as boring, stupid, unnecessary. And yet there seems to be growing interest, especially among millennials, or certainly a part of millennials, in rediscovering the benefits of simply living, or living simply. And some of this might reflect a kind of nostalgia for the pre-industrial or pre-consumerist world, and also sympathy for the moral argument that says that living in a simple manner makes you a better person by building desirable traits such as frugality, resilience, and independence, or a happier person by promoting peace of mind and good health and keeping you close to nature. On my block, where I lived, on Covert Street, there was a woman who was a retired school teacher, and I would go up as a kid because she would make sassafras tea with honey, and the honey came from bees in her backyard, as did the sassafras. And I would sit there on a swing, and I'd watch her, and she would always have this very contented feeling about her. And I asked her about what it was like to be old. I'm like 5 years old. And she would always smile and when she spoke to me, and she said, "I have lived a decent life. I've lived a moral life. I've helped people as a school teacher. I helped your father. He was one of my students." And she said, "So I'm at peace with myself. So I enjoy the simplest things of life." And she talked about the flowers that she planted and tended. And I never forgot that. I've never forgotten the moments I've had in my life with people who were wiser, almost always older. And then when we travel, if we travel to a place as wonderful in its tapestry of differences as India, and you see people who financially have nothing, nothing, and yet they're at peace, and they find happiness within their family, within what they do, within their environment. And this is not just there. I remember so many times going down to Jamaica and people who have very little financially, but they live close to nature. And for them to go out and to pick off a persimmons from a tree, you know, it's joyful to have neighbors and friends and family that you love, spend quality time with. It's joyful, but it's a simple life. It's not complicated. The people who are more complicated almost always have more problems. But we don't pay attention to this, and we should. So I believe that the problem is just that our practice conflicts with our professed beliefs. Our thinking about simplicity and luxury and frugality and extravagance is fundamentally inconsistent. We can condemn extravagance that is wasteful or tasteless, and yet we tout monuments of past extravagance, such as the Forbidden City in Beijing or the Palace of Versailles, as highly admirable. The truth is that much of what we call culture is fueled by forms of extravagance. Somewhat paradoxically, then, the case for living simply was most pervasive when people had little choice but to live that way. The traditional arguments for simple living, in effect, is a way of rationalizing necessity. But the same arguments have less purpose when the life of frugal simplicity is a choice, one way of living among many. Then the philosophy of frugality becomes a hard sell. That might be about to change under the influence of two factors: economics, that I talked about earlier, with all of our debt, and sooner or later, this giant bubble that we're living in is going to crash. And I believe sooner rather than later. And then environmentalism, because we have denied the consequences to the environment of our excesses in our consumerist-based society. Buy it, use it, throw it away, but don't be concerned about where it's thrown and how it impacts nature. And then one day, the environment strikes back. And then what do? We do not use reason, we react. So when recession strikes, which will be soon, as it has done recently, but on this time around, far worse. And you find tens of millions of people suddenly in circumstances where frugality once again becomes a necessity and the value of its associated virtues is rediscovered, then it's a positive. In societies such as the United States, we are currently witnessing a tendency for capitalism to stretch the distance between the have-lots and have-nots. These growing inequalities invite a fresh critique of extravagance and waste. When so many people live below the poverty line, there's a somewhat unseemly about in-your-face display of opulence and luxury. Moreover, the lopsided distribution of wealth also represents a lost opportunity. According to Epicurus and the other sages of simplicity, one can live perfectly well provided certain basic needs are satisfied, a view endorsed in modern times by the psychologist Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If correct, it's an argument for using surplus wealth to ensure that everyone has basics such as food, housing, health care, education, utilities, and public transport at low cost, rather than allowing it to be funneled into a few private pockets. However wise the sages, it would not have occurred to Socrates or Epicurus to argue for the simple life in terms of environmentalism. 2 centuries of industrialization, population growth, and frenzied economic activity has bequeathed us smog, polluted lakes, rivers, and oceans, toxic waste, soil erosion, deforestation, extinction of plant and animal species, and global warming. The philosophy of frugal simplicity expresses values and advocates a lifestyle that might be our best hope for reversing these trends. In the very near future, in the next week or two, as soon as I finish this one last filming project, I intend to do a webinar on what we can do, those of us, and there are many, who have something that they can share with others, so that those who have less have more and cover some of their needs, including having some people who are homeless and giving them a place to stay until they can get back on their feet and helping them in that process as well. And if you were homeless, if you had no hope, if you had no money, if you didn't know where you were going to sleep tonight and you were looking more at the weather and where you would go to the bathroom, and then wouldn't you also want someone to help you? So I'm going to do a discussion with those who are interested on how you can take in homeless people. You can't just run out and take someone in, because you have to also be aware that some of the people have emotional problems and some of the people you would end up having problems with. I can tell you that from personal experience, because I've taken in a lot of homeless people into my own home to help them. And some are terrific, meaning they use that as an opportunity to grow, get their health back, and then take the next step in the next journey of their life. So I'm going to talk about this and how we can get back to a simpler life. All that's coming up. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. In just a few moments, we're going to hear from Nora Erickson, the president of SameVax, about the dangers of the human papillomavirus vaccine and an update on developments against Gardasil and Cervarix efficacy and safety. But this is just my way of saying goodbye, good friend, and to a wonderful human being, those who knew him, those who were benefited by his presence, Fred Fisher. He lived an extra 20 years, and I'll have the actual video up on my website, prn.fm or progressiveradionetwork.com, a little later today. But this is the audio clip of him talking about his journey.
I did a movie with Robert De Niro, The Bronx Tale, and I told him I was 480 when I got the movie, but I really was about 580, And I was gaining an average of about 25 pounds a month while we were filming.
Put him in a bathroom, Sonny. Any more, she said, they ain't gonna fit.
They give you anything you want to eat when you do a movie and you're a principal character, and I was out of control. So I was just like, you know, bugging out and eating everything, you know. And even De Niro, one time, he had mentioned to me that the fellow that played Clemenza in the Godfather had died from obesity, because he would do the same thing. He would just eat, you know, constantly eat, and then go back for more. And, you know, nobody would ever say nothing to you on a movie, you know. They just give you anything you want.
When I started my journey, I was 720 pounds. That was the nearest we could get to it, because then the scale just didn't, there was, you know, then I started to have to go in the junkyards to get weight, because there's just no scales, you know. I was in congestive heart failure, liver failure, kidney failure. I lost the circulation in my right leg. Every morning I used to get up, I used to vomit blood every day. And the doctors were like, you know, they told me I had about 6 months to live. Hi, Myra, how you doing?
Hi, how you doing?
All right, baby, what's going on?
Fred came to me because he gained a lot of weight. He was over 600 pounds, at which time he was getting very, very short of breath and tightness in the chest. When I examined him, I found him to be in congestive heart failure. I told Fred he had to be in the hospital. I was going to arrange to put him in the hospital at that time. However, he refused to go to the hospital. He said that he was afraid of the hospital. He was petrified. He didn't want to go. I said, we'll do the best that we can, but he really belonged in the hospital.
Everybody wants to know, how did you get to be over 700 pounds? Huh? But it's just like, you just watch the news, you get depressed, and then things in your life happen, friends die, and that hurts me. I can't, you know, when you want to help somebody and you can't because they're dead already, you know. So I started gaining weight again, and I just felt like, you know, and I tried to get jobs, but they wouldn't hire me, you know, stuff like that. You're too old, this and that. So that was another thing that led to my depression, was the factor of the money, you know. I was arrested one time, and I got abused by the police department, like being a big person. And even though I was arrested under false things, and I got an apology from the DA at the time and everything, for 3 days I was in hell. I was in hell, pure hell. And, you know, it's not a nice thing when you're big and you got to be abused by people that don't even know you just because you're big. You know, they don't even know what kind of person you are. And things like that, you know. And when I was really, really 700 pounds and I couldn't move no more, and I just sat down and I started thinking, you know, how did I get here? And different situations like that, you could see in those times in my life that I would gain 100 pounds. I'm going to... Gary opened up his heart to me. He opened up his place in Florida. I went down there, you know, and that's all I asked for. You know, I'm not looking to be a millionaire, zillionaire. I just want to, like,
get healthy and bring health to other people and show them that, you know, we don't have to live this American dream of you got to have Cocoa Puffs in the morning and all this other nonsense. And, you know, we'll see how it goes.
I'm feeling great, I'm doing it, and, you know, like 2-3 weeks straight, I'm eating good, I'm taking the vitamins, you know, I'm taking the supplements.
In the mornings he does his exercise with his weights by the window he sits and does, and he goes to the gym where he don't sit in every day no more. He goes and does exercise.
The bicycle in the gym, when I first started I only could do 5 minutes, and now I'm up to like 25 minutes to a half hour. I started listening to Gary Nolan. I started working out with him, and as the months passed, I kept getting weighed. The last Thursday of every month, I usually go to get weighed. One. The better you get, the easier it gets.
Everybody asks me what kind of diet I'm on, but it's not a diet. It's a change of life.
Wheatgrass, this is amazing, this stuff. This stuff gives you energy like beyond belief. You drink this like every day, and it's like, it's unbelievable what it does for you.
I make them as juice of the vegetables, collard greens, carrots, apples, celery. And he'll drink 16 ounces of that for breakfast before he eats his breakfast.
Oh, we got some good stuff today, huh, Jenna?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't eat pizza no more. I started eliminating milk. Then I eliminated sugars. And then I eliminated the caffeine.
So
So the next time you hit a bump in the road, and we're always going to be hitting bumps in the road, there's always going to be crisis, you will have learned the lesson of your crisis.
He's got a different attitude now, where he gets up and goes, and he does things.
And that's Fred Fisher. On the protocol I put him on, he lost 350 pounds. Let me say that again, 350 pounds. Circulation came back in his body. His diabetes, normal. Blood pressure, normal. Congestive heart failure, gone. Arthritis, gone. Depression, gone. Anxiety, gone. And liver failure, reversed. He had, when I saw him, by the time I saw him, it wasn't 6 months. He had a week, 1 week, doctor said. And you heard the doctor there. Doctor says, we got a crisis here. Someone your weight, undergoing a heart surgery, there's almost zero positiveness in this, meaning you're going to die on the operating table at your weight and your age. But if you don't get the surgery, you're absolutely going to die. Either way, he was dead. That's when he decided to make the change. So let us learn a lesson from Fred, wonderful human being, because for the last 20 years, he has motivated so many people to get themselves healthy. And that is the joy of this story. Always sad when someone passes, especially someone that you work with, but to know that they lived 20 years, helped a lot of people, and leave a very positive legacy is important. Now that my guest who's standing by, let's go over and say hello to Norma Erickson. Nice to have you with us today, Norma.
Nice to be here, Gary. Thank you.
Norma, people may not remember that a couple of years ago, a former pharmaceutical physician employed by Merck, the manufacturer of the human papillomavirus Gardasil vaccine, stated in a French publication that, quote, I predict that Gardasil will become the greatest medical scandal of all times because at some time the evidence will add up to prove that this vaccine, technical and scientific feat that it may be, has absolutely no effect on cervical cancer, and that all the very many adverse effects which destroy lives and even kill serve no other purpose than to generate profit for the manufacturers. And now there are a couple of new developments regarding the human papillomavirus vaccines that give further credibility to the doctor's predictions, and one is new developments in the human papillomavirus scandal in Japan that involves the World Health Organization. And earlier this year, Japanese families whose girls were severely injured from Merck's Gardasil and Glaxo's HPV vaccine, Cervarix, filed lawsuits for damages. And second, the Nordic Cochrane database group filed another complaint against the European Health Group over the maladministration of the vaccine with Brexit safety. So seemingly in Europe, there are very credible people, independent scientific warnings against Gardasil, and yet nothing in the United States. So please give us an update about both the cases and the mounting evidence that both Gardasil and Cervarix are neither effective nor safe. The form is yours.
Absolutely, Gary. Dr. Dalberg's statement is unfortunately coming true every single day. I'm going to update your viewers a little bit in case they don't remember what happened in Japan. Japan approved the vaccine later than most other countries, and they instituted a program for inoculation with a government recommendation, and the government was paying for it. Only 6 weeks after they instituted that recommendation, they pulled their government recommendation due to, and this is a quote, an undeniable causal relationship between persistent pain and the vaccination. A few months after that, the World Health Organization came down with a scathing statement condemning them for making such a decision, stating that policy decisions based on weak evidence leading to the lack of use of safe and effective vaccines can result in harm. An organization in Japan called MedWatcher Japan is composed of pharmacists attorneys, physicians, consumer advocates, sociology professors, side effect survivors, and parents of side effect survivors. They were established in 1997, and their sole purpose is to monitor and prevent drug-induced disasters. This organization came out with a very, very strong rebuttal to the Global Advisory Committee's vaccine safety statements, where they disclosed that 11 of the 15 GAVCS members had direct ties to pharma. And this is how they determined what the cause of reactions after HPV vaccinations were. They only looked at four possible causes. Number one, neurological disorders. Number two, intoxication. Number three, an immunological reaction. And number four, a psychosomatic reaction. However, for numbers one, two, and three, which were physical causes, if there was any hint or suggestion in the person's record of a psychological disorder or a psychosomatic disorder, they went with psychosomatic. If there was evidence of a psychosomatic disorder, they ignored all potential physical disorders. And this is according to MedWatch of Japan. And their reference for that data was taken from the minutes of the GAVCS meeting. That in and of itself, if that's not enough, they also disclose the fact that HPV is equipped with various immune evasion mechanisms, which cause the immune system to become more tolerant to the infection and creating an environment susceptible to further infection and facilitating progression of cervical intraepithelial neoplasm, CIN, precancerous lesions, if you will. To counteract this evasion system, HPV vaccines are designed to maintain extraordinarily high antibody levels for more than a decade, 80 to 100 times the normal antibody reaction. And according to MedWatch of Japan, this shifts the HPV vaccine out of the paradigm of a vaccine as we conventionally think of one. So in other words, this is a huge human health experiment that they know absolutely nothing about what will happen.
Well, we've been defrauded, that's all. And it's a cover-up. I believe that one of the movements we should do within the vaccine movement is have all the vaccine organizations lobby with letters, with articles, with documentaries, and then with a public protest in Washington to take back the indemnification clause so that the vaccine makers are held liable for damage from their vaccines. Because if you take that away and then they start doing what they've done in the past, all of them will go bankrupt.
Absolutely. There's not another product manufactured on the face of the planet that has indemnity from prosecution.
That's correct. Well, Norma, your group is doing a lot. You're out there sharing all this with the people, and I appreciate it. And I want people to know that if you want more information, just go to SANE, S-A-N-E, VAX, V-A-X.org. And my guest is on the line now, Norma Erickson, and she will share with you the latest scientific information. And to help on this issue, we have posted, Norma, 41 articles that I've written with Richard Gale, one of our scholars in residence, fully documented, as you know, all of our articles are, on every possible explanation of vaccines, including one specifically on Gardasil, as well as three films we have up for people to watch to educate themselves, to share. And people should watch and share on progressiveradionetwork.com. So let's get the information out. Let's get people educated. Let's let them know the truth. And then when that's done at the grassroots level, we will begin to move on getting the indemnification taken away from them through the legislative process.
You have I do have one additional piece of information that you would most definitely be interested in. I'm sure that you're aware that GSK just got Cervarix approved for use in China.
Yes.
Well, the former advisor to the Commission on Disaster History, the person that was in charge of disaster prevention, has posted on his personal website in China 30 papers revealing harm caused by the toxicity of vaccines, particularly HPV vaccines. There, he's working with multiple scientists and professionals there to try and rescind that recommendation before any injections are made. And I can forward that link to you also.
Do so. We will share it. We're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me, Gary.
All right. Tomorrow I'm going to show you in a commentary how close we are to the end of the Roman Empire. I'll be showing you the different factors within the different groups and how we're playing that out today. Also, tomorrow I'll be doing a commentary on how a top group of doctors reveal vaccines turn our immune system against us. And that will be an important one. And also how local governments can now prohibit GE crops in their area. That's according to the U.S. Court of Appeals. And more, lots more on tomorrow's program. Remember, every day at noon, Monday to Friday, you can listen live by calling a number. Write it down, please, 701-801-3662, 701-801-3662. And now my favorite kind of music to inspire one to deeper thinking and elevate your energy, gospel music.